All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest today is Sheldon Richmond, the editor of The Freeman, the journal of the Foundation for Economic Education. That's thefreemanonline.org. He's also a fellow at the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, and keeps the blog Free Association at SheldonRichmond.com. This piece at thefreemanonline.org is entitled, Is Serfdom an Executive Order Away? National Defense Resources Preparedness. Oh, Sheldon, you alarmist you, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Always great to be back.
Very happy to have you here. What is the National Defense Resources Preparedness?
Well, this is an executive order that President Obama issued about the middle of last month, basically directing members of the cabinet to get us ready for a national emergency. I guess that'd be the way to put it. In other words, were he to decide there was a national emergency, he wants to make sure the government, the executive branch, I should say, because even the government's too general, Congress is not involved in this, that the executive branch will be able to commandeer the economy in order to, see the crisis through. And so it goes into detail about what he wants various cabinet members to do, to, you know, assess our resources and industrial base and be prepared to do what's necessary to get it up to what it needs to be. Basically, the government would have first claim on all resources. There is a reference also to military conscription in there, so to military manpower. And, like I said, in case he decides there's a national emergency, and this seems to be just an unchecked power.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, in the 1990s, I don't know where I first found it. I think I just found it trolling through executive orders on Bill Clinton's website, maybe. I found 12919, which is the Bill Clinton version of this exact same thing. And now there may be a blogger somewhere or another that went and compared, you know, paragraph for paragraph, what all the difference is. Obviously, now there's a Department of Homeland Security, and so things have got to be, you know, reorganized a little bit. But in fact, I haven't even read the new one, but I did read the old one, the Bill Clinton one, very well. And, of course, this goes back kind of in conspiracy theory lore to old Bercher stuff from the 70s, because Richard Nixon had these same kinds of executive orders in place. And then, of course, Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush and all the way through had them, too. But by the time of Bill Clinton, this really, like, flipped me out, and I was just, you know, I don't know, in high school and really learning about politics and real politics around that time. And I thought, well, this must be the goal of all of this. This is actually the blueprint for the day the other shoe finally drops and they quit pretending we even have a constitution anymore and just decide to make America a totalitarian state. Because as you say, it's not just an authoritarian thing where they declare an emergency and so now, you know, it's martial law and you could be shot if you disobey, that kind of thing. It actually describes in detail how to seize all transportation, all medicine, all food, all trade, all everything.
Right.
And it's actually pretty breathtaking. But then my question is, what are they waiting for? Why didn't Bill Clinton go ahead and make himself the emperor and start shooting lightning out of his hands back then?
Well, let's put this in a little bit of perspective.
Obama implement it himself a month and a half ago instead of just saying, everybody get ready? Why didn't he just say, all right, everybody give it up, your money or your life, buddy?
Well, he hasn't declared a national emergency, and I guess, there are always political limits to these things, even if they're not legal limits. So if today, just out of the blue, he said national emergency, I'm taking over the economy and imposing martial law, I expect that they would anticipate some resistance to that because it doesn't really seem to be a national emergency. So, you know what I mean? There's going to be some political limit on what he can do. I want to put this in a little bit of perspective because I don't want to join in the Obama hysterical chorus who thinks this is something unique to Obama. As Robert Higgs points out in a blog post to which my article links, you know, the government has exercised this sort of power. In World War One, it basically took over the economy, and of course we had a draft. It then lets the powers recede. They don't always formally repeal them, but they put them kind of on the shelf. This is Robert Higgs's whole ratchet theory, namely that in a crisis, the government assumes new powers. After the crisis, it may give them some of them up, but it may be an informal giving up, and they may be available anytime the government wants them. And he points out in World War II, the government did the same thing. It then relinquished them until the Korean War started. And then after the Korean War, they were sort of put, like, again, put on the shelf. And then meanwhile, in 1950, they passed this National Defense, what is it, Resources Act, which then, you know, it's there when they need it. That's kind of a theory. So Obama here is just on the basis of that. And he cited the, it's called the National Defense Production Act of 1950. He cited that act as the basis for his executive order. In other words, the broad authority, I guess, is in the act, but now he's telling specifically what the Secretary of Defense, Labor, Homeland Security, you know, and so on, Secretary of State, just going down the list, what it is he expects of them to be ready for a national emergency, and then what they're able to do in a national emergency. He's putting sort of, you know, the flesh on the bones.
And, yeah, it really is something to read through it. And they really have thought this through, huh, what it would look like. Although I wonder, like you said, there are political limitations. Is this basically, you know, all hyperbole aside, really just for after a nuclear war or something to save the last little bit of, you know, because the state, of course, always is going to put its own survival first under the premise that no one could survive without it, so... Right. You know, is that basically what we're looking at here? Is that if the society is obliterated, they have total power in some old law to refer to consolidate what's left?
Well, that's, I'm sure, part of it, and they've always had plans for that. There's a big underground headquarters somewhere. It's like a city underground somewhere where the government could carry on. We should all feel, you know, rest assured and sleep well at night.
Yeah.
The government will carry on in case of a nuclear war. But I think they have in mind things that are less than that. Who was it that said, you know, if there's another terrorist attack, the Constitution is suspended? Wasn't that somebody
Tommy
in the Bush
Franks.
Administration?
It was Tommy Franks who was the head of the Iraq invasion.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. I don't think they see nuclear war, the big one, as the only scenario in which this kind of thing will kick in.
You know, I got to tell you, after September 11th, this is the state of my paranoia at the time. I was so pleased and thankful that, like, I could have prayed grace over it or whatever, that George Bush merely asked the governors to please call out their own guard units and put them at the airports instead of nationalizing them all and putting them there just as a start. And I remember thinking, oh, what a great half measure, less than what I thought might happen there. I mean, they could have got away with quite a bit worse, in fact, at the time. Although I'm not, obviously I'm sort of joking that, you know, it's all matters relative here.
I'm not saying, you know, this is about to go into effect. I think they realize for political purposes it would have to seem pretty extreme. But I still think that extreme is something short of, you know, the Soviets and the Chinese and the U.S. all beginning a full exchange. And let's throw the Israelis in while we're at it, a full nuclear exchange. So, you know, I think it would have to be something pretty big, but I don't think it would have to be as big as, you know, World War III.
Yeah. Well, someone I knew told me when I first stumbled upon this stuff, Executive Order 12919 under Bill Clinton, that, you know what? They've had these powers since Nixon, and Nixon didn't invoke them in 1968 when the whole country was being torn apart. So you should probably breathe easy for a little while anyway. But we'll have more with Sheldon Richman from The Freeman, thefreemanonline.org, right after this. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Sheldon Richman. And, you know, all these timed heartbreaks, it doesn't always lend itself to proper explication. I did not mean to say, Sheldon, that you're saying that, oh my God, Obama's going to do this tomorrow or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a meme going on out there that this is all about to happen. I think that's what you were, referring to when you said you weren't trying to play into that. It's sort of the whole, Obama's a Kenyan, level stuff. But on the other hand, this makes it very clear that the people who run the government of the United States of America consider that virtually every square acre of property in America belongs to them. Every hospital belongs to them. Every bandage belongs to them. Every port, air or sea, belongs to them. Every road belongs to them. Every person belongs to them in order to defend the government. I mean, there's a lesson in there for you, people, which is that nationalism at all is really communism. At the very basic level, it's Marxism, at least in security. And this is what you get. Ultimately, it ends with, all roads lead to Soviet totalitarianism, man.
That's what's instructive about the executive order, not that it's anything brand new. It's that that's the mentality, that in the end, the state owns everything, including us.
Eminent domain. I used to think it was imminent domain, like, hey, pal, the road's coming through here imminently, and you got to get out of the way.
No, eminent. That's exactly right. And listen, even without eminent domain, if you own land, if you own a house, you really are just renting it, because try not paying your property tax. We don't call it rent. We call it a tax, but it's a rent, isn't it?
Yeah, liberals like to say, hey, even Thomas Jefferson was in favor of that. And so, therefore, there's a limit to your individualism, Sheldon. If Jefferson was a communist on the issue, then you got to be, too.
Yeah, but that's the point. You can't, when the government decides that we're in an emergency, you may not say no. It has first claim on all contracts. It says right in that executive order that it can make any contract, first of all, required acceptance. In other words, if the government wants you to, if let's say you have a factory and you make widgets and they need widgets, they can make you accept the contract and make you put that priority ahead of everything else. And too bad. I mean, it basically now owns it. In effect, if it can tell you what to do with it, it's the effective owner of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's nominally still private property.
Yep.
So that's what I think, that's why I thought it was worth writing about this. Not that it's Obama, the Obama taking over, Obama's a Marxist, that's all nonsense.
Right.
It's a reminder, because this is true for every regime, it's a reminder that ultimately the state owns everything.
Well, our government has done nothing but go around making sure that there's a whole bunch of people in the world who would like nothing better but to commit some acts of revenge against the American people, and in a way that can make our government overreact and destroy us even faster or whatever, probably the better for a lot of them. And so we could be in a situation where, I don't know, six cities are on fire because of some planned thing. A 9/11 attack in three cities at the same time. Oh no. Something on that level where, we have an unlimited number of people probably willing to try something like that in the world, unfortunately.
Well, that's,
and they
that's,
could, this really could happen. This is a government that now claims the power to, like Dick Cheney proposed and Bush vetoed it. No way, we can't do that. He wanted to send the army after the Lackawanna Six. And Bush decided not to order. But now that's basically just codified that Obama can send the military after us if he wants to with the, NDAA now.
Yeah, well, that's the key point. I mean, you can't take any comfort in the fact that, this could only be invoked in a national emergency. The government can create a national emergency, intentionally or not, by its fooling around in foreign policy.
We're under 1,000 different, hundreds of different national emergencies right now. Probably they never repeal them. They just move on to the next one,
Yeah, but December 7th, 1941, people generally regarded that as a national emergency. But the government had spent a couple of years goading the Japanese, as Secretary of War Stimson put it at the time, just a few days before Pearl Harbor. We talked about how to maneuver the Japanese into firing the first shot. So they could create an emergency. That's not the problem. So for them, it's not a problem. For us, it's a problem. So, this isn't just, there's no need to worry about this. This is only if there's a dire emergency. The government can manufacture an emergency, and has many times throughout our history.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the one politician who predicted the financial crisis of 2008 through right now is predicting another one when he says we're going to face a Greece-like crisis where our government sovereign debt is no longer worth anything on the market, and at that point our currency becomes worthless and the savings of tens, hundreds of millions of Americans are completely wiped out, and we have a serious financial crisis in this country. And, you know, I don't know if that means it's definitely going to happen, but sure doesn't seem like they're electing him. So,
well, you know, my old friend and a very good economist named Jeff Hummel at San Jose State has written repeatedly that the two issues are really separate, the currency and the debt. And he predicts that there will be a default because the government will have no other way to pay that, because inflation doesn't do it for them anymore. They don't reap cash from inflation the way governments used to, and they can't raise taxes beyond a certain limit because it doesn't raise the revenue, and there's no will to cut spending deeply. So that he says the only alternative they're going to have is to default, but he doesn't predict a currency collapse as a result of that. So I am not upset.
That doesn't mean monetizing all that debt and having the Fed just pay it off with inflated money?
He thinks there'll be an outright repudiation. Because monetization doesn't get them what they want. Inflation doesn't get them what they want anymore. He's got the numbers. I mean, even in the 70s when we had the high inflation, the government was not reaping cash from a result of that. It wasn't getting the seniorage it used to be, you know, called. Which is the difference between, you know, what it costs them to print money and the value of the money that they get to spend as a result.
Well, and they're in between the rock and the hard place already, right? Where if interest rates go up at all, they can't pay the interest on the debt anymore. It's already more than $500 billion a year,
right,
just the interest on the national debt.
Yeah, they'd be chasing their tail. The other thing is the markets are much more sophisticated these days, and of course the high tech tools.
But so you're saying they can repudiate all that debt, but it won't destroy the currency when they do it?
That's Jeff Hummel's. I mean, I'm not a money and banking expert. He is.
Sounds like fun.
He teaches money and banking and banking history, so he knows the both sides of it very well. Mm-hmm. And he says it would not cause he doesn't believe they're going to try to inflate their way out of it because they'll realize they can't do it. First of all, people will flee the currency very early on, right? With the tools they have today, the computers and everything, and the worldwide currency markets that can react so quickly, they get an early clue if the Fed were to start to kick that into motion, and would immediately get out of it. So that will neutralize the effects of that. So it's I think some of those doomsday scenarios on the monetary side may be overblown, and I think repudiation would be a good thing. First of all, I don't believe they should be taxing people to pay that debt, because the people didn't ask for the debt. The politicians did. And it seems to me if the government has a choice of who to pay, voluntary creditors or coerced creditors, like, say, Social Security recipients, I side with the coerced creditors, not the voluntary creditors.
Mm-hmm.
Look, anybody that buys a bond from the government knows what it's doing, and they've chosen to do it.
Yeah. I'm with you, except, you know, people with their pension funds invested in them and that kind of thing out of their control, right? But
well, but of course, inflation or high taxes, which squelches production, won't help those people either. So
right.
This is the mess the government has given us. They've dug this huge hole, and now they're looking to blame somebody else. And it's their
well, the real
fault.
Solution, I'm pretty sure Jeff Hummel agrees with this, is just to abolish the state entirely. That way there's nobody to collect a tax or pay off a bondholder anyway.
But of course, that would be repudiation. That's right.
Absolutely. Repudiate the entire thing. Popular sovereignty. What kind of BS is that? Who ever heard of that?
It's not very popular, in my view.
No, it's not. I don't even know if people know that that's the thing to repudiate, but I repudiate. All right, well, now, but here's the thing, though. Back in the real world, instead of me getting my way, what we have is, and this is something that we talked about before, was James Bamford and the National Security Agency and the new pieces that he's written for Wired about the Israelis, too. I don't think we've covered that on the show, and that's in the book, The Shadow Factory, as well, which I highly recommend to everybody. But in his new Wired piece, Bamford quotes an NSA whistleblower as saying, listen, this is, and he's really paraphrasing, might as well be paraphrasing, Senator Church from the 70s, saying, this is a turnkey totalitarian state. We are, the only thing we have is our pretended respect and interest in the old law. Other than that, we could be, it could be absolute 1984 Big Brother land around here. Unimagined totalitarianism, basically.
Well, Bamford knows what he's talking about. I have great respect for him, and I take that very, very seriously.
It's problematic. Well, you know, it's, I guess, you know, people are always going to get it too late, but it does seem like more and more people are getting it that the solution to most of these crises is to just scale back state power. I don't know if they'll ever get it. That's the solution to all of them. But more and more, it's seeming like it's apparent to people that the government's the problem in the first place. You know, I don't know if they can follow through on the logic there. But
well, that's right. And there is a sort of a, forgive the term, as I don't like psychiatry much, but a schizophrenia there. I mean, people do have a sense that the government is way too powerful. But when you get to specifics and say, do you want to cut, you know, X, Y, or Z, even Tea Party people say no. So, you know, they want to cut in general, but they don't want to cut specifically. Unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and as long as they got Republicans and Democrats for people to switch back and forth on, you know, we'll be kind of screwed anyway, but...
Yeah.
Anyway,
Well, Warren and Iran will take our mind off all of this.
Yeah, you know, I wonder... Let me ask you one more thing then about the money repudiation thing. If they do just go ahead and repudiate the debt, is that going to have an effect on the troops? Because I guess that to me was going to be the silver lining of the dollar breaking when they pay off the debt with inflated money was that then the troops, I mean, I hope they don't get stuck and have to hitchhike home, but, you know, that they'll have to come home because they won't be able to pay them with money that's worth anything to be soldiers anymore. But it sounds like I'm worried that maybe they'll be able to keep the, if they just repudiate the debt and start over, they'll be able to keep the empire going the way it is.
Well, maybe we should use that reasoning, which seems pretty legitimate, to launch a campaign to end the wars now before the government doesn't have the means to bring them home.
Yeah, there you go. You don't want them stuck out there in Central Asia, do you?
It'd be a sales pitch, wouldn't it?
Well, but wait a minute. If they just repudiate the debt, won't all of Asia want to go to war with us?
Well, I don't think so.
Because, I mean, they own trillions. I mean, what would happen to them? They own trillions of dollars worth of our debt, right?
The Chinese, well, the Chinese.
And the Koreans and the Japanese, too?
Yeah, the Chinese and the Japanese, yeah, I guess they all own some. I think sometimes it's overblown how much the Chinese own. But, they own a fair amount. Well, we'll give them warning. Give them some warning.
Oh, there you go.
So they can you know, reshuffle their portfolios.
Hey, as soon as that really starts happening, let me know, and then I'm going to try to figure out the futures market there and play some appropriate currency bets, that kind of stuff.
Well, you're probably going to know before I do.
I actually don't have any money except maybe a jar of change to get started with, but you know, if I play my cards right, I could turn it into millions.
Well,
in proper circumstances, like George Soros betting against the Bank of England.
I don't really have a hedge against all this either myself, so I think you'll have to rely on Charles Goyette.
Yeah, it seems like more of us Austrian-leaning types ought to use our knowledge to make money. Like, I knew about the housing bubbles and the dot-com bubbles because of Ron Paul especially, you know, in real time back in the late 90s, and then after that, the first collapse there, then on to the second bubble, and... instead of just spending all my time driving a cab and doing pirate radio, I could have been betting on vaporware and then selling at the right time. I would have got out before the bubbles crashed.
Yeah,
I was way paranoid
about
it.
But I would say caution your listeners to not to think that because you know Austrian economics, you are then you can become a crack investor. Because Austrian economists will tell you that kind of knowledge of theory is not what helps you make decisions, you know, on the ground when you're confronted with alternatives. You know, you could be a good Austrian economist, get into a bubble, and then if you get out in time, you've made money, you're fine. But the point is the timing. You don't know when the timing is going to how it's going to take place. Theory can't tell you that kind of stuff. So I'd be very careful thinking all I need to do is read Man, Economy, and State, and I'll become a great investor.
Got a great anecdote like this. I know a guy who had a business building skate parks, and he was completely hip to Austrian business cycle theory, and he went all around the country with all these localities flush with millions of dollars of property taxes and all the increased inflated housing values and whatever. And he convinced them to build these gigantic, super expensive concrete skate parks that'll last forever and ever and ever. And all he did was he waited till he read the Wall Street Journal every day. And as soon as they raised the federal funds rate by a quarter point, he knew that this is the part where Rothbard talks about in America's Great Depression, where they try to prick the bubble and just let the air out slow, but it never works. Yep. It always ends up collapsing. But once they start to try to prick it, just go ahead and get out then. That's when, old man Kennedy said, his shoeshine boy had decided to speculate in the market, and he knew it was time to get out. that's when you go ahead and get out, when the getting is good. Sell all your equipment at your inflated rate to another bubble construction company that doesn't read the Wall Street Journal, and then you're set. And it worked out for him. So he was using the Austrian economic business cycle theory to make a great play based directly on the housing bubble. Isn't that great? And there are thousands, it wasn't just him, it was a lot of other people, thousands of permanent giant concrete skate parks all across America as Alan Greenspan's legacy, which you got to give him some credit, man. You kind of have to.
Well, I will.
All right. Hey, thanks very much for putting up with me and joining us on the show again, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's the great Sheldon Richman from the Foundation for Economic Education, thefreemanonline.org, sheldonrichman.com, fff.org, and we will be right back with Adam Morrow live from Cairo, Egypt, right after this.